Hello and welcome to Rules-Based Audio, a Lowy Institute podcast. In this series, we're exploring the rules-based order, a concept that is ever more prominent in debates about how the world works and how it should work. My name is Sasha Fegan. I'm a research associate on the Australia Security and the Rules-Based Order Project here at the Lowy Institute. I'm recording this podcast today on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to acknowledge and pay my respects to them, as well as extend my acknowledgement and respect to the traditional owners of the lands right across Australia, and indeed around the world, wherever this podcast is being heard. In this program, we're taking a closer look at influence and manipulation of the public sphere in Africa. There's been increasing concern in the West that the Russian and Chinese governments are using their state-owned media companies, as well as government-backed social media campaigns, to manipulate public discourse, particularly in the global South. We've seen influence campaigns exploiting ethnic tensions and promoting anti-Western narratives. But how widespread is that in Africa, and how do these narratives fit into the broader information ecosystem in Africa? I'm very fortunate today to be joined by two quite different experts on this topic. Idayat Hassan is a lawyer, development expert, and director for the Centre for Democracy and Development in Abuja, Nigeria. And Danny Madrid Morales is a lecturer in the Department of Journalism Studies at the University of Sheffield and the author of the book Disinformation and the Global South. Welcome to both of you. Danny, can you start us off by giving us an overview of the media space in Africa? I'm interested in the degree to which people get their news and information from what we might see in the West as traditional sources like news, TV, radio, and what proportion of people are on social media.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us to this conversation this morning. And I'd say it is difficult to give you an answer that applies to the whole of Africa, right? So we have to keep in mind whenever we think of Africa that Africa is not a country, as the joke goes, that Africa is a combination of 54 different nations and that there's different levels of development in terms of the media space in different parts of the continent. So my answer is going to be a bit patchy because I wouldn't want to generalize for every single country on the continent. That said, if we want to compare the landscape in the majority of African countries to the rest, maybe Australia or Europe or North America, there's two things that I would say stand out. One is that there's still a very significant prevalence of legacy media, particularly radio and TV. For a lot of people on the continent, radio is the number one source of news, which is something that might have disappeared in other parts of the world. And that comes from a couple of reasons. One is, for many people, electricity is an issue at home, and therefore having a radio is the easiest way to keep connected to the world. And the second reason is that a lot of people find it difficult to engage with the internet because of high prices of internet connection. So I think that that's one of the reasons why legacy media is still very prevalent. TV is also important for, I'd say, the majority of households, and the evening news are still a go-to source for information. Now, that said, obviously, there's a young generation of Africans that have turned to social media and the internet to get news from. Mobile access is widely spread across the continent, and we see that a lot of African countries have done what we would call a leapfrogging. So they've skipped sort of the landline connection to the internet, and they've gone directly to to social media and mobile phones, and that's how they get the internet. But again, I wouldn't want to generalize across the whole continent that that's the situation. Some markets, South Africa, Nigeria, Kenya, are very dense and diverse, and maybe there it's sort of like a different situation. But I'd say in the majority of African countries, legacy media is still very prevalent.
Idayat, as Danny mentioned, a lot of people in Africa don't have personal access to the internet. I think where you are in West Africa, it's Nigeria and Ghana have the highest rates of online access, but that's still only about 50%. So can you explain how narratives on social media get traction when so few people are actually online?
Yeah, oh, thank you very much. I think it's important to point out that of disinformation in Africa, and not just in West Africa, there is actually a bloodline between the online and the offline. Yes, the numbers might look small, like 17% internet penetration, 20% internet penetration, but it's important that in most one single radio or one phone can actually act as a pavement radio where more than 200 people will sit together and listen in a community. The word of mouth also goes around with some of this. What is discussed online becomes topic on popular radio station because people, of course, do radio listening. And Facebook is often used, and other platforms are used as affirmation even when people are carrying rumor. So the link really between the online and the offline is very, very blurred. And focusing on the small numbers of people online and to determine what our response will, it actually blurs it, the opportunity to make that change that is needed.
You mentioned Facebook there. And when we're talking about social media in Africa, Facebook really is ubiquitous. It's the biggest platform by far, isn't it? Can you just explain its reach and penetration and how important it is in Africa?
Yes, Facebook being the longer. Facebook is like the most, Facebook and WhatsApp are actually the most popular platform across all ages and social strata in Africa, really itself. So it gives the opportunity for people to engage, to have their community, religious, school association, closed group, aside from the open groups. So these closed groups on Facebook are also very, very an insidious platform for passing Facebook, for passing disinformation. Beyond the fact that what is also foreign, some of the foreign disinformation, take Australia, take from the United States, conspiracy theories that are posted there are easily, the algorithm allows it to actually be seen and be posted on the continent. And because of the free basics future of Facebook itself, it gives the opportunity for more people to have access with it without necessarily having to pay anything. So it is the most popular, and it also cuts across social strata, unlike Twitter and TikTok now, which is more of the elite-like and also the younger generation who are able to communicate on those platforms. But these platforms, the important point to also make is that there is always a cross-posting. So what appears on Facebook will find its way onto WhatsApp platform, will find its way onto Twitter, or be screen munched from TikTok, and it finds its way onto Facebook. So this cross-platform sharing itself also masks the bigger, allows penetration to grow more than what is initially envisaged, especially when now complemented with words of mouth.
I want to get onto the types of narratives that you both are seeing. Danny, there's been a lot of reports of fake accounts across the global south. We've seen it in the Middle East. We've seen it in Latin America, in Southeast Asia, in India, pushing very pro-Russian messages and equating Russia's invasion of Ukraine as a move against what they might call US imperialism, and also Chinese narratives denying the genocide in Xinjiang. I'm just wondering if you're seeing those pop up, where are you seeing them pop up, and how are they kind of perhaps cross-pollinating?
I'd say in the cases that I've looked into, I wouldn't say, for example, the Chinese are particularly using fake accounts to spread those narratives, but they are definitely using their own social media, the social media accounts of Xinhua, CGTN, and other state-owned media to spread some of those narratives. We've seen, I'd say that this, in the case of China, and I know Ilayat is probably going to be able to speak more about the case of Russia, I'd say there's three main narratives that China has really pushed across the continent that follows sort of like a borderline between disinformation and not disinformation. And I think that that's something that we can talk about later. And one, obviously, Xinjiang, as you said, the Xinjiang narrative has been very prevalent. China has looked for the support of many African nations at the United Nations level in sort of passing resolutions that support the response that China has had on Xinjiang. And for that purpose, China has used social media significantly on that end. There was a very strong push of anti-Western narratives around Hong Kong. And that's probably at the beginning of the process where China started using social media to spread what we could call disinformation narratives. And the third one obviously has to do with COVID-19. China has sort of bombarded the world with pro-China COVID-19 narratives, some of which can be said to be disinformation. Obviously, when China accused Ford was in the U.S. Yeah. of being the source of COVID-19, that's a very clear case of disinformation. But at the same time, you have China saying, oh, we are the number one donor of vaccines around the world, which technically is false because they are not donating most of vaccines. They are probably selling those, right? So in some cases, there's a blur between what's true and what's not and what's just partially true. So on the case of Russia, I think that a very interesting scenario that we've seen is how a lot of Chinese media are parroting Russian narratives, right? You'll see a lot of Chinese media quoting Interfax and Intertas, Russian news agencies. And in doing so, they are spreading those narratives across the continent. And for many African media, Chinese media are number one source of global news coverage. Things like Xinhua and CGTN, Chinese state-owned media, are offered for free across the continent. Many newsrooms have access to global news because of those services. And therefore, when you have to fill in the pages of your newspaper or your website needs content, you pull that content from Chinese media, and those Chinese narratives are going to be replicating Russian narratives. And that trickles down onto the rest of the media space.
Danny, you've looked very closely at China's digital diplomacy in Africa. So I'm just wondering if you can explain a little bit more about who the target audience of China's online diplomacy is, and how that might have changed in recent years.
Let me give you an example. A couple of years back, 3 years back, before COVID, I talked to some of the people who are working on the social media platforms of CGTN in Africa, the Nairobi newsroom. And one of the things that they would tell you is that their goal is to influence elites. And there's this idea that for a long time, both Chinese academics and Chinese practitioners have had, that their goal is if you influence elites, opinion makers, opinion leaders in the African space, those are the ones that are going to be then hopefully pushing those narratives across the system. And Idiad was saying earlier like this, how important word of mouth is, right? So if people are going to congregate around a radio station or maybe even a phone to look at what others are saying, right? So if you target opinion leaders that are going to be replicating some of the Chinese narratives, that's going to help you spread yourself across. Now, what I think has happened between then, when I was able to talk to some of these practitioners, and now, is that China has changed its strategy. Now, there's a lot more interest in what Chinese leaders call managing public opinion, the same way that was done within China for many years, where you try to guide not opinion leaders, but the general public opinion towards issues. And that's when we see a lot more engagement with civil society, a lot more engagement with what you would say regular folks on social media, where diplomats and other actors are very, very active on social media, responding to people who accuse China of things that they don't think are fair. And that kind of engagement with audiences was not there before COVID. And that's why I think this COVID clearly marks a very significant change in how China engages with other audiences online.
Idiad, is this what you've been seeing as well? And could you tell us a little bit more about what you've observed from the Russian narratives?
Oh, thank you very much. I think Russia has actually been building on China's existing media infrastructure in Africa, just like Dan explained. And the narrative of the two has been overarchingly is more to reinforce their governance approach, just to say, like, the China option, the China or the Russia actually gives more opportunity for the development, economic development, ability to lift people out of poverty, ability to solve the COVID crisis without the kind of challenges and debt seen in the global north. This whole thing about also being the savior of the people and not their enemy. They are the savior, while the West is actually the enemies of the people. I think they want to. So these are basically their narrative. And most of these narratives are not just in vacuum. It also depends on where they work and how they work. So the kind of Russian disinformation that targets Nigeria, of course, is very minimal compared to what targets Central African Republic, Mali, and Burkina Faso as well in all this. And when it comes to Russia, beyond the online, there is actually the diffusion of the offline, which is becoming more and more frequent. And I think one point we did not make is the fact that they exploit this colonialist tension that is in the nation. Maybe that's the most important thing. So they exploit it and say, West Africans already have a preconception of France as the bad guy due to their colonial history. So why do we not help to fan these embers in such a way that they become an unwelcome partner in the country? So I think that's a very important point to make, that they exploit this colonialist narrative and the cleavages and divide from that, or the grievances of the people. They mobilize it against other nations. And I think a final point to make would be then what they did with Ukraine. I think they with Ukraine, which is also a learning, that the kind of narrative that were pushed in countries like Belarus, Poland, and elsewhere were also the kind of narrative that were actually pushed in places like West Africa. And this narrative was quite simple. One is saying that the numbers as announced by Ukraine is actually exaggerated. The war is a needless war. That's another one. And of course, that's and the cause of the war, Biden and Co. just wants to grab more power. And that is why they are doing this war. The cost of the food, the high cost of food is actually precipitated by this war, causing unnecessary suffering.
Danny Idiot mentioned tailoring messages for different nation states, but there are also thousands of ethnic groups across Africa. And I'm interested in finding out more about how disinformation that we're seeing exploits tensions in those multi-ethnic societies.
I agree 100% with what I was saying. I was thinking about a couple of things. One, you were asking about whether there's some tailoring of disinformation to different groups in society. And I was thinking of the case of Sudan. I think that Russia had a very tailored response to the conflict in Sudan, where the disinformation targeted specific groups of society, right? Remember, Sudan had the pro-democratic movement, which draw the society between traditionally ethnic lines or ethnic groups. And I think that that's a good example of where maybe some of the targeting into different groups of society goes. But even the case of Sudan speaks of something more broadly that I think characterizes both Russian and Chinese disinformation. And that is, it tends to align with those in power, right? So a lot of what these disinformation narratives are doing is they're strengthening those that are within the places of decision-making, in the sense that you don't want to create unrest that's going to go against those that are supporting you. Right? And in countries like Burkina Faso or Mali, where you see this tension that they were describing between traditional Western powers, colonial powers, and new actors like Russia, where you have the Wagner group trying to get into the Malian security space. In those cases, disinformation is always going to be trying to make those in power stay in power, as opposed to creating or supporting pro-democracy movements. That's never going to be seen as an action of disinformation by either Russia or China.
Just on that issue of content moderation, I'm just wondering if the gap in content moderation for those smaller language groups is manipulated and exploited by local political actors, or indeed by Russia and China. Idiot, what do you think?
I think that doing better content moderation would determine having more people with the local knowledge, not just language knowledge, but the nuances itself. So one is that the number of people, like Facebook already started having like Hausa people, Hausa language as one of the language to actually moderate. They are trying to moderate content on their third party partners who just flag and show. But the response is quite poor, not as much as you would think is done. It should actually be done and immediate also. But the fact is, beyond even these languages, the nuances are quite important. There are different ways of saying things in local languages that the algorithm being used cannot actually capture. You could just say, kill everybody like cockroach, once we hear cockroach, we start thinking of, the Tutsis, Rwandan genocide. But ordinarily, you wouldn't think of cockroach, just put them or something like that. It wouldn't possibly be picked by algorithm. Then when you now start talking about local nuances, local languages, this becomes even difficult to take. Then again, beyond that is also the fact that the attention given to African countries are very, very limited. It's all dependent on the geopolitics of it. So the emphasis will be on Nigeria, South Africa as Kenya, particularly in the prelude to their elections. Like, these are important countries. But what about all those other countries? In fact, Ethiopia is even an example where we saw failure to remove content and how that actually helped in spiking the war, the killing going on in Tigray. So this, I think the response is, as far as I am concerned, I know that I also want to acknowledge that compared to other platforms, Facebook is actually doing more compared to the other platforms. But even as that fact that they are doing more, it is quite limited. It should be much more expansive and it should be inclusive. So now we are talking about community standards. Community standards cannot just be set without understanding the local nuances and conversations beyond the local experts, but to the local people who utilize this, and engage in it. So I think on the general note, we need global standards that talks about what are the rules, what should we do, irrespective of what country. But when it comes to the local, then we have to ensure that we nuance it locally as much as possible in such a way that it becomes beneficial. And this tech is a force for good, not representing a force for evil that is gradually becoming.
I want to get on to exactly those potential legislative actions that could be taken in a minute, but I just wanted to come to you, Danny, because you mentioned something interesting about how disinformation narratives were often shoring up, I guess, particular leaders in particular countries and used in support of them. And I just wanted to get into this area of content moderation, I guess the vacuum around content moderation. And I just wonder if people, particularly people from smaller language groups in Africa, are able to say things that they might not be able to say if they were in an English-speaking country because of that lack of content moderation, and if that's exploited by local politicians.
Let me give you the example that's most current right now, which will probably be the case of Kenya. Kenya is going to have national elections in August, and we've seen a surge in disinformation on TikTok, for example, in the case of Kenya, where Zidaya was saying, while Facebook has been pushing significantly its content moderation, even though it's not perfect, and in countries and multilingual countries, this is really, really difficult. TikTok hasn't been doing a great job. There was a report recently by the Mozilla Foundation that showed how much linguistic differences in Kenya are facilitating some of this disinformation being spread, where algorithms are not trained for languages that are widely spoken, right? So Swahili, English are widely spoken in Kenya. You have a lot of content moderation in those languages, but then you have smaller languages, Luo, Kikuyu, and so on, that are not monitored regularly. And you have a lot of hate speech going through in those languages in ways that they would also happen in legacy media, right? You have a long history of some community radio stations being sources of hate speech. We run a workshop or a sort of a roundtable a few months back with some Kenyan media. And one of the things that some of the media professionals in Kenya were saying is that it is really difficult for them even to do content moderation and fact checking because of the linguistic diversity of the country, right? So if you think of like the national broadcaster of Kenya, of KBC, that broadcasts in all of the languages of the country, it's impossible to have somebody who's able to speak all of the languages, right? So if you have somebody saying something in Somali, in the Somali radio station, you need to find somebody who can speak Somali and then Swahili and English to be able to engage in the process of fact-checking. And those are small nuances that become really complicated when that multiplies by the number of languages. And I think that sometimes we don't think through of the specificities that Idaya was saying of local communities where we try to implement solutions that might work in monolingual countries like the US. Even if the US is not a monolingual country anymore, right? But UK, for example, where you have both the language proficiency and the technical capabilities to enforce some of these solutions. And then when you start thinking like that, you move away from sort of like technical and technological solutions, and you try to bring more social solutions to the problem, where education, media literacy, and a bunch of other solutions come before using technology to prevent disinformation from spreading.
Let's get on to solutions. Idaya, you were talking before about what potential legislative solutions there could be. So I just wonder if you could actually talk about first how local governments, in particular nations in Africa, have started to try to legislate around disinformation, and whether you think what they're doing is doing more harm than good, because they are sort of dispersed responses that could also be used to clamp down on dissent, for example.
I think the emphasis in most of the African countries has been to legislate against disinformation. So there's been lots of laws introduced on cybersecurity. In fact, at a point in time in West Africa, we had most of, like 11 out of the 15 ECOWAS countries trying to amend their laws to be able to punish fake news. Some have also resorted to China in terms of helping them. But this attempt, there has also been lots of shutdown of internet, shutdown of platforms, as ways of dealing with some of these issues, particularly during conflict, during elections. But most of it has actually been very counterproductive, because it helps more in fueling disinformation. And it does not also take into cognizance that this disinformation in our own context is not just online, but actually it navigates both the online and the offline space. So that's quite a problematic. But what is very important moving forward, really on the African continent, is on this, having a greater understanding of what the information ecosystem is all about, and keeping up with the techniques that are actually being used by these actors. So we need lots and lots of researches, and this research should actually be consistent, because the bad guys are moving faster, more than the good guys who are trying to monitor what is actually happening itself. Then fact-checking is important. We need people who are able to sort out facts from the fiction from us. But by fact-checking, it's not just the fact-checking where you just post online. There has to be a partnership between the media, the civil society, conventional media, print media, and even having ambassadors at local level who can actually speak to these issues. But that must also be accompanied by openness from the government themselves. And I think the final point, particularly when we start talking about foreign influence operation, is actually support for quality journalism itself. We have left it too late, especially the global north. While the China and Russia have actually given financial and technical support to media organizations, they form partnerships with some of these media groups, content sharing, training. Like, that might be the only opportunity for some journalists to travel out of the country. All the countries have left it far behind. So there is already a prevailing ecosystem, which is now forming a bulwark to even the response that is currently ongoing.
Danny, what do you think? We've seen the EU about to introduce a Digital Services Act, which will bring out quite sweeping new laws to regulate social media. Is there a need for a kind of overarching legal framework for social media companies in Africa?
That's a really tricky question. And I've been thinking about how to, when Idaya was speaking, I was thinking, for example, of the case of COVID-19, where we saw quite a few African nations come under the guidance of the African CDC, and how, with the help of the United Nations, there was a response force to tackle COVID-19 disinformation that was quite successful in creating shared campaigns that could be spread across the continent, multilingual campaigns to fight disinformation on the COVID-19 issue. Now, What I think is tricky when it comes to particularly for disinformation that is either of political nature of or that comes from foreign influence is that there's going to be very different sensibilities on some of these issues, right? So what to some countries, like if you think of the case of Ethiopia, what to the Ethiopian government is a really serious issue of disinformation, it might not be to other countries, right? For example, when Ethiopia accuses of Tigray's of spreading disinformation, that might not be seen as disinformation by other actors. So with these political nuances, it becomes a lot more difficult to find a consensus on what should be done. And I think that if you extend that to the case of foreign disinformation, then it becomes even more complicated. You've seen, for example, in recent years, particularly with the change of administration between the Trump and the Biden administrations, that the United States has become a lot more proactive in its fighting of disinformation. But in doing so, they're obviously pushing a very strong anti-Russia, anti-China narratives in a lot of the efforts that the U.S. is doing. So for some African countries, that kind of narrative might not be something that they are happy supporting because they don't want to take sides in these sort of like U.S. versus the rest or China-Russia versus the West confrontation. So in all of those scenarios, it becomes very difficult. And if you think more strategically, information warfare, which has been going on for many, many decades, has always been an issue of national politics. And as a nation, you want to have control over the information that circulates in your country rather than share a space where other countries are going to be able to influence your policy or your actions on that matter. So I don't think it is a very feasible solution to have a widespread, continent-wide strategy. In some issues, it might work, like the case of COVID-19, but when it comes to political information, it might be a lot more complicated. And then obviously it comes with how do you regulate platforms across different political systems where different countries might see freedom of expression from different perspectives.
We'll have to leave it there because we are running out of time today. But I just wanted to thank both Idiat and Danny. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today.
Thank you for having us. Thank you very much.
Danny Madrid-Morales is a lecturer at the Department of Journalism Studies at the University of Sheffield and the co-author of Disinformation in the Global South. And Idiat Hassan is a lawyer, development expert and director of the Centre for Democracy and Development in Abuja, Nigeria. This podcast is supported by a grant from the Australian Department of Defence. My name's Sasha Fegan. Thanks for tuning in.